This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking at the escalating crisis in Syria and wondering how America, France and Britain might respond. We'll also be looking at the world of drill music and wondering whether it's responsible for the rise in crime in London. And finally, we'll be asking, what happened to girl power? First up, President Trump is facing a major foreign policy test in the Middle East. Reports came in over the weekend of a brutal chemical weapons attack in Douma. The most likely suspect is President Assad, or as Trump likes to call him, Animal Assad. But as Paul Wood asks in this week's cover, how certain can we be that it really is Assad's doing, and what will the US do in response? Paul is the BBC World Affairs correspondent, and he joins me now, along with James Forsyth, our political editor. So, Paul, we seem to be in this slightly extraordinary situation now where we have a standoff between Trump and Putin. How quickly do you think things are going to escalate?
When this happened last time, it was a matter of hours almost between tweet and missile launch. But this time they're contemplating something much bigger, maybe multiple strikes, multiple targets over several days, maybe with British and French involvement. And now with the Russians squaring up against American action. So it's a lot more complicated. There is a planning process to go through. The Americans are moving military assets into theatre, as the generals like to say. People are talking about the weekend.
James, how likely do you think it is that there will be strikes in the next coming days?
I think it's almost certain that there will be strikes. If you look at the Trump tweet today, it makes it crystal clear that he plans to hit Assad in response to this attack. I think what is interesting is how quickly this is becoming a US-Russia standoff. You had the Russian ambassador to Beirut today saying that Russia would not only shoot down any missiles that were going to endanger its troops that are based in Syria, but also any missiles that were going to hit anywhere in Syria, and suggesting that they would hit where these missiles came from, which would essentially mean attacking US submarines or warships from which these were coming. I think we know that President Macron is very keen for these strikes to happen, so I think we can be pretty much guaranteed that France will be involved. The UK position is less certain. I think the Foreign Office are very worried about being left behind if France and the US act and the UK doesn't. But Theresa May has a problem with this recent precedent of asking Parliament for permission, and the Trump tweet will definitely make that more difficult. It is a reminder of the temperament of the US president that you would be launching these strikes alongside.
Paul, how certain can we be that it was Assad? You mentioned in your piece this question, which was the same as it was in 2013, why would Assad do the one thing most likely to bring about a US attack on his power? Do we have an answer to that?
We don't, and in one sense, you know, this is inexplicable. We have no independent witnesses on the ground in opposition-held Syria now, or very, very rarely, and certainly not in Douma. So we simply don't know what happened. And this is more than just a routine caveat that reporters have to insert into their copy. This matters a lot. We have to take as evidence videos that are filmed by citizen journalists who are probably being controlled by rebel groups, in Douma's case, Islamist rebel groups, or are loyal to them, or in any event, rebel supporters of some kind. So it matters in that truth matters, whether there was in fact an attack by the regime. It doesn't matter in the other sense, which is that the Americans have come to their conclusion. They believe the regime did it and they're going to punish Assad for that.
James, is Theresa May going to have to go to Parliament to seek approval?
I think she now probably will, because it looks like the strikes won't happen quickly. If the strikes happen on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday of this week, I think she could have got away with saying Parliament wasn't sitting, I took the decision, and then had a retrospective vote after it happened. The longer it goes on, the more difficult it is to decide. We know that Trump has cancelled his trip to Latin America for this weekend. The question is, when do these strikes happen? If these strikes happen when Parliament is back, as it is next week, I think it's very difficult for her to justify not asking Parliament for permission first.
And if the strikes do happen, what exactly will be the point of them?
I think one of the arguments that senior people in the British government make to me for these strikes is that these would be punishment strikes. That this doesn't actually require you to have a strategy for
Syria. But who will it be punishing?
The aim is to basically send a message to the regime, the Assad regime, that if you use these kind of chemical weapons, and the theory is, Paul knows a lot more about this than I do, but just to reflect the kind of thinking in Whitehall. The thinking in Whitehall is that Assad is using these chemical weapons because there are certain places where the rebels in them will fight to the very death, to the very last man. And he's tried besieging these places. That hasn't worked. So now he is using chemical weapons as a kind of final attempt to clear out these places. And the aim is to send a message that basically, every time you do this, we will blow up a bunch of your runways from which you launch these strikes. So don't breach this red line on chemical weapons.
Yeah, there was a deal a couple of weeks ago for Douma to be evacuated, people to be put on buses and sent up to the northern province of Idlib. And it broke down apparently because the Islamist rebels in Douma don't get on with the rebels up in the north of Syria and started to drag their feet about going and also wanted to hang on to their heavy weapons. So the situation on the ground also kind of doesn't make sense in terms of why the regime would launch this attack now when they seem to be negotiating the surrender of Douma. Again, we're not on the ground and we simply don't know. And you're quite right, these are punitive strikes with the limited objective of deterring the future use of chemical weapons, something that Assad promised not to do again in 2013. And if he's guilty this time, lied to the international community. This is Obama's original red line, which Trump has taken up. But it's more than a gesture, but it's almost gesture politics firing these missiles, because what do you do the day after? There certainly isn't a plan for how you bring peace to Syria. And squaring up against the Russians, as President Trump is doing now, removes the only viable option, which diplomats will tell you was what they were trying to pursue before this latest flare-up in tensions. If there is to be a peace deal, the Russians have to be on board. It has to be some kind of great power conference. They're the only people capable of strong-arming the regime to the negotiating table. So America versus Russia in Syria means no peace deal and the conflict will continue.
James, Trump is clearly a very erratic leader, and Macron might be keen to ally with him, but do you think the British government really should be doing the same?
So I think there is a feeling in of a defence and diplomatic establishment here that essentially America and France are going to be the UK's two key security partners in the coming years. France, basically, is the way that Britain is going to stay involved in European security. The fact the French are talking about setting up this European intervention force outside of EU structures that would make it much easier for the UK to be involved, that is something that is kind of bonding the UK to France on that respect. The special relationship with the US has always been key to UK foreign policy. And what the UK wants to avoid is a situation where the France and the US become a new partnership that would kind of undercut the UK's importance both in Europe and in Washington. So I think that is kind of part of their argument for why you should be involved. I do think there is a temperament issue here, which is Macron is a former investment banker. He knows how to deal with real estate guys who have big egos and think like this. Theresa May is, you know, her finance job was as a Bank of England economist. She is not used to dealing with someone like Donald Trump. And you talk to people in number 10, and these phone calls between Trump and May are bizarre, because May is very methodical, ordered, wants to go through a kind of checklist of things to discuss. You call Trump, you get whatever the first thing on his mind is.
Now, you have to sympathise. I'm not sure that any leader's had experience of dealing with somebody like Donald Trump. If you look at the transcripts of his news conference before cabinet, utterly typical Trump in that it's a sort of free association of ideas, circling round and round again to the idea that American forces are great, sprinkling in some other ideas in the middle of that. If those are what the telephone calls are like, it must be extremely trying for the Prime Minister. When Trump ran for office, he would come out with this very repetitive meme about, we never win anymore, but I'm going to make you so sick of winning, we're going to win all the time, we're going to win, win, win. Unfortunately, he's learning in office that problems like Syria are not susceptible to an outcome where you can say, oh, we've won, we can leave now. Take the case of the Islamic State. Bomb the shit out of them, Trump said. To some extent, that was done, and they have been routed. But into the vacuum left by the Islamic State has rushed the regime. Oh, wait a minute, the regime is also bad. Well, if you help other forces like the Kurds are fighting the Turks. Wait a minute, the Turks are our allies. Whatever you do to deal with one problem, it leads to a worse problem after that. And this is the reality of the situation that Trump is facing, and why it's so important to know what is the strategy for after the missiles are fired and the dust has settled.
Just finally, Paul, you characterise Trump's current problems as porn and poison gas. Do you think there's an appetite in America for war at the moment, or do you think they're perhaps more interested in the kind of salacious side of the president's life?
Well, it is just astonishing. If you watch cable TV every day, there's some incredible Trump story, often several of them. And now we have a revival of the Clinton era split screen presidency, with sex and legal problems for the president in one half of the screen and a foreign war in the other half of the screen. There are people who are critical of President Trump who think that this is actually a strategy of his to just simply wear people down with the daily run of revelations about his private life or about the investigation or sacking people or speculation about getting rid of Mueller, the special counsel. I'm not sure that that is true. Reports out of the White House say that Tuesday, a day when you would have thought President Trump would have been agonizing about the huge decision he's about to take to step up a foreign war, he was instead railing to aides about the raid on his lawyer's office. That's Michael Cohen, the guy who, quote unquote, used to clean up Trump's women messes. And a lot of people think he's winding up to fire Mueller over this and will use the distraction of a foreign war as the means to effect this change. So it's this kind of crazy daily roller coaster ride. I don't think the president is doing this. I think the public is quite weary of it. How any of this will end, nobody knows. But I think for the next few months, at least until the congressional elections, which may move Congress into Democrat hands, you're going to see constant speculation about whether Trump essentially plunges the US into a constitutional crisis by firing the special counsel.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks, James.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next, could there be a new culprit responsible for the rise in violent crime in London? Police cuts might have made prevention of crime more difficult, but as Harriet Sargent writes in this week's magazine, young people are listening to music that glamorises violence between gangs. It's called drill music, it's a subgenre of rap, and here's a clip.
If you're late and bitch dizzy be writing some statements, trying to lock a real nigga in the cages. I hit a nigga in his face, my nigga hit a nigga in his back. Trying to score every time that we ride. Someone told these motherfuckers don't lack. I was in the party flexing with the yaks. They know I had a satin in my bag. I was drunk off the yak. Ops never came true because they knew they'd get a slap. They had a real nigga locked in a cage.
Harriet joins us now, together with Jermaine Lawler, a rapper and the founder of Voice for Youth Against Violence. So Harriet, in the past you've obviously spent quite a lot of time working with gangs in London, and in your latest piece you look at drill music. First of all, could you tell us a little bit about what drill music is?
If you look at sort of drill videos, they're not like sort of other music videos, which, you know, have lots of kind of glamorous women and faraway places and palatial houses. It's not about aspiration. It's about life as it is for these young people on their local estates, on their streets. And it's about what concerns them, which is, you know, gangs and guns, and keeping a scoreboard of their rivalry between the different gangs and rapping about this. It is a sort of peculiar combination of the kind of domestic and the lethal, because you have young boys rapping about stealing a knife from mummy's kitchen and, you know, how you use bleach in order to get blood off a knife. And when you're looking at these videos, I mean, everything is made to make these boys look big and frightening. And when you look closer, you get over these, you know, terrifying lyrics and the fear and everything. You get look closer and you see that these boys are mostly sort of 14 and 15. And they're young, they're school kids. They should be at school. They should be under adult care, but they're not. And that drill rappers, on the whole, I mean, it is a very much a young boy's business. I mean, the sort of first drill rapper chief, he was only 16 when he got his sort of major deal. And this is the age group. And I think we should be sort of thinking of why we're not looking after these boys better and actually giving teenage boys what they need to thrive.
Jermaine, you obviously work in the front line against gang violence and launching your own music label soon. What do you make of drill? Do you like it?
Yeah, I do. I do like it. I think that what it is we have to understand that the people that the musicians that are actually making this music, where are they coming from? They're sharing stories, they're sharing the experiences, and they're sharing a lifestyle that they live and that they're caught up in. Now, I feel that the issue within the community is that we're using music, social media, scapegoats to tackle the real issue at hand. So we're using drill music to justify why the murders are on the rise. But this was happening before drill music was around. And it's been happening, so we can't use drill music as a scapegoat. We can't use social media as a scapegoat to justify why murders are on the rise when these issues have been present beforehand.
I mean, Harriet, isn't it true to say that, you know, there's always a kind of middle-aged panic about whatever kind of youth culture there is, whatever music is prominent at time of violence? I mean, is this just the latest panic, do you think?
Yes, I mean, again, if you, I spent quite a lot of time looking at drill videos, and when you look at them, again, if you put out of your mind that these boys are judging it themselves by how many people they're stabbing, actually, it's just exactly the same as if you talk to a group of boys about their rugby game or their football game or, you know, whatever, some competitive sports game. It's just that we have totally failed to give these boys what they need. And so in that kind of void, they've created gang violence. You look at the kind of, I don't know, the house system or sports system in schools or whatever. What boys need is a sort of activity and discipline and hierarchy and competition. And this is what they react to. And when you look at these videos of these boys, this is exactly what they've recreated. You know, there is nothing more competitive or hierarchical or active than a gang on a drill video. It's just that we've left this void and not given, and state schools are not giving boys that opportunity. So they are creating their own kind of Lord of the Flies version. And that seems to me very, very sad.
Jermaine, do you think that's fair? That, I mean, it's kind of creating a sense of community, but not necessarily the kind of community we want to be creating?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think that's spot on. Definitely that we're seeing young men that are socially excluded from society and as a result have formed their own society, and that's what a lot of our communities are doing and have had to have done in order to survive, especially with the present circumstances and at the time. So it is a community, and I feel that there needs to be a lot of education around understanding and young people being able to differentiate what when a rapper is speaking from first-hand personal experiences and when he's actually speaking on entertainment purposes. Because it's not the same, it's not no different to rock, and some of the things that happen at some of the rock events, the hardcore heavy metal events, are quite atrocious in terms of some of the things that happen and how the music can be interpreted. It's up to one's interpretation in terms of some of the things they talk about. And you see that across all genres of music, that there's some negative and there's some positive, because there's music that is actually positive within the drill sector. It's not all negative. You've got people talking about how they've came from nothing to something. And that's positive, coming from a community where opportunities are scarce and it's very difficult in terms of accessing these opportunities.
There's definitely positive ones I have listened to. But the trouble is it's, you know, it's so difficult for these boys. I mean, I became friendly with them, four boys in a gang in South London. This is about 8 or 9 years ago. And I then did a report on black Caribbean and white working class boys. So I looked into this in quite some depth, and the majority of them drop out of school at 14 and 15, which is the sort of key age that these boys are in drill music and fascinated by it. And a lot of the ones I met and interviewed could barely read and write, and 4 years later were in prison. And it's very difficult for them to get back from that. You know, obviously Jermaine Hughes has got back from it, but it's an incredible achievement and it's really hard. So we should be doing something, I think, a lot earlier. I think we should be doing something in primary school to hook these boys in, because by the time it gets to secondary school, it's too late.
Jermaine, what do you think we can do about, you know, knife crime on London streets and gang culture?
Voice for Youth Against Violence work and specialise in working at the preventative stage, which is going into schools where areas are gang affected. So we know that this area has lots and lots of gang issues. We know that there's lots of stabbings. We know that there's been recorded incidences of gang rivalry around schools. So what we've done, we've contacted school teachers independently. We've gone into the schools and we've delivered a workshop over a period of, say, three, four sessions a week. And we've been looking at the consequences of being involved in a gang, dispelling some of the myths, because a lot of young people, and we've been very surprised in terms of how much knowledge they actually are aware of. An 8, 9-year-old can be fully aware of what you need to do to be in a gang, the lifestyle that comes with it. And they're only 8, 9 years old. And they're very, very, very aware of the outside in terms of the surface level things. But when we start to unpick some of the consequences and the impact it has in the long terms on your families, on your physical and psychological well-being, then they start to change their mindset. We have a police officer there that talks about joint enterprise and the law side of things. Then we have a mother who's there who talks about what it's like losing her son from being stabbed. Then we have a paramedic there who talks about how much blood you lose when you're stabbed and gives a live demonstration. Then we have someone like myself who's been there, lived it, tells them about the consequences, tells them about the difficulty in getting out, and talks about how you can better your life. Someone who's a positive role model, they can look at me and say, yeah, if he's done it, I can do it.
And what was it that allowed you to escape from gang life?
It was a series of things. The first instant thing that just came to my mind was faith in God. That's what really helped me. And I'm not religious. I believe religion is a way of governing people, and I believe there's lots and lots of good principles in religion. And I'm not religious, but finding faith in God, that's what gave me the strength. It was also coupled with going to funerals, you know, burying my friends at a young age had a negative impact on me, and it opened my mind up at a young age to realise that life is very fragile. Like, I'm here today, I could be gone this evening.
What age was that, that you were burying your friends? Was it kind of
13, 14 years old.
A similar age to the... But I mean, obviously, Jermaine, your group Voice for Youth Against Violence is trying to use music to help young people. I mean, do you think, we're obviously being quite negative about drill music, do you think actually it can be quite helpful for people?
Yeah, what we do is we don't tell people what to and what not to say. We show people how to compose songs. We show them about the industry in terms of how to get into the industry, and we provide mentoring. So with music and such, we show them and teach them that it's a positive outlet. A lot of young people that come to us, a lot of young men come to us angry, frustrated, and they've got stories and they've gone through injustices and they want to talk about it. They want to get it out of their system and they want to share it with the world. So what our job is to help them do that. Now, we do challenge lots and lots of young people around positive lyrics and, you know, negative lyrics, because they do have a consequence, and we talk to them about the consequences in terms of how that can have an impact on the listener. Now, if you've got a rival gang member who's listening and you're putting derogative terms and threats and you're saying you're going to do this and you're going to do that, that's going to add to the problem. So when they hear that, they're going to respond to that and they're going to make a song, and they may well choose to look for you. Now, we're showing young people the dangers of that, and we're trying to encourage young people to, not saying that you have to be positive, but be real to yourself, be true to yourself, be real to your experiences, be real to your lifestyle, and then think about the consequences that your lyrics have on other people. And that's what we do. But it's initially just providing a platform for young people, because young people are passionate about music. Now, we shouldn't be blaming all of the crime that's taking place on music. That's using that as an scapegoat, but it's about understanding the influences that music has. But it's not no more of an influence than film, then computer games, then radio, inappropriate billboards. In one breath in society, we're saying that this is inappropriate, but in the other breath, we're saying it's okay to buy a game that's full of violence and you're only 12, 11 years old.
And we can have a listen to some of your music now, Jermaine.
Lost on the block and I was kicking it, just killing shit. The life that I was living was ridiculous. We was infamous, no limit with this wickedness. Us on some killer shit, the purchase from the dealership. We'll go around, come around on some realer shit. You stacking or spending, niggas pretending. Ops were getting popped and the doctors couldn't commend him. Thought about my life and the many ways I could end it.
Money. Can you tell us a bit about what that song's about?
Yes, I wrote a song and it's called Pressure. And basically, it's just looking at the different pressures that were happening at my life and the pressures that were occurring in my life, surprisingly, were occurring in so many other people's lives, as it does do, but you feel so isolated at the time that you feel like you're the only one going through it. So it's really just looking at the difficulties in terms of the circumstances at a particular time where my dad died, one of my friends got killed, and it was just talking about my feelings, really, in terms of depression and how that can have a consequence on your actions and your decisions.
And where can people hear more of your music?
You can go to SoundCloud/Low From The 9, V4YV Media on YouTube, Twitter, www.v4yv.com.
Thank you, Harriet, and thank you, Jermaine. Lastly, as news of a Spice Girls reunion arrives, Cosmo Landisman celebrates but also asks, what happened to the spirit of the Spice Girls, who got what they really, really want? It seems that girls nowadays have forgotten the previous generation's empowerment and are now willing to buy into a victimhood narrative. Cosmo joins me now, along with Aisha Hazarika, Evening Sun columnist and comedian. So Cosmo, in your piece, you mentioned this concept of Generation Geisha. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Generation Geisha are a group of women who claim that their whole life, their emotional life, their social life, their sexual life, their professional life, is given to the devotion of making men happy. They don't want to upset men, so they just go along with whatever men do. And my question on the piece is, where are these women when I need one?
Aisha, do you recognise this concept of the Geisha generation?
Cosmo, what to say? Maybe it's you. So I think the geisha generation is a very interesting phrase. I think it's kind of been there time immemorial because the structures of society are quite set up for women to please men. I mean, when I was growing up, the construct, and I have so many conversations with my friends about this, who were very kind of empowered, ambitious women. But there is this psychology from when you're a wee girl, which is the good girl. Be the good girl. Be the girl that does everything right. You've got to be perfect at everything. I went to an all-girls school, and I remember one of our prize givings, the headmistress basically said, you want to set yourself up to be the kind of girl that the boys from Kelvinside Academy would want to marry. That's the type of... So I think for a lot of us, we did grow up with those kind of... things ingrained in
us. Which decade was this? Because I would say if you grew up in the 1950s, I might understand this.
Oh, this was in the 1980s, 1990s.
But in the 1980s, there had been a massive break.
No, you think you've had it. But well, in terms of having had the lived experience, I don't think that's the case.
Well, we were in a sort of post-Betty Friedan, post-Germaine Greer kind of world where women were no longer... The women I were meeting weren't sort of that way.
The women you were meeting, that doesn't necessarily seem
well,
women
per se.
Well,
that's true. It's a selection of a metropolitan, perhaps, example.
But Cosmo, in your piece, I mean, what age group are you talking about? Because you're talking about the Me Too generation and the Spice Girls generation, and then you talk about Nigella Lawson. These are all different generations of women.
The funny thing about this generation is it's not confined to either young women. I hear young women saying, I hear older women saying the same thing as well. And that's very surprising.
Or maybe that's because throughout the generations of women, that is a shared and lived experience of what it is to be a woman. You know, we're definitely making huge strides in so many ways.
But still,
we are still in a society, whether it's our work structure, whether it's our family structures, where it is still quite patriarchal.
Do you feel that your primary concern is making sure that men are happy?
No, because I'm single.
If you had a man, would you be devoted to his happiness?
No, that's why my relationships didn't go so well.
Well, you win. I can't argue with that.
I grew up listening to the Spice Girls, and I suppose I'm now part of this kind of Me Too generation. Do you think just it's the kind of reality of growing up and realising that life isn't quite as straightforward as the pop songs would have you believe?
Well, yes, we all realise the pop songs lied to us, but that doesn't mean to give up on them. You know, I also think that a lot of this has emerged because some women want to get in on the Me Too act and they don't have real cases of abuse or, you know, as victims of patriarchy. So they say, oh, you know, I slept with this man because I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So they become a victim by their own choices. And that's what I think is wrong.
Now we've veered into entirely different subjects. So the validity of the Me Too thing. So
No, that doesn't question the validity of the Me Too. It questions a strand of people that have leapt onto Me Too.
It's very difficult to say who's leapt onto the Me Too thing or not. I mean, certainly a lot of women are feeling that for the first time in, like, gosh, such a long time, probably ever, that there is this moment of reckoning where you can actually talk about your experiences. And
I'm not against that. I'm all for that. I'm talking about this other strand of what I would call more have to do with victimhood than male abuse.
But I don't think that's the right way to look at it. Why should you be the arbiter of what's good and what's victimhood?
Well, I'm not an arbiter. A lot of women are saying this as well, and that's what's led to the split of the Me Too movement.
Well, I don't know if
this
there
is
a split.
This is not just a male objection. A lot of women commentators have been saying the same thing.
I don't think women are just one homogenous group that all have the same view. And I think, interestingly, there's been quite a generational divide on this Me Too stuff. I think older women, whether they're in the media, whether they're actresses, commentators, are probably much more on your side, and maybe it's an age thing, that they're much harsher on some of this Me Too stuff. But I think women from the younger generation do feel that actually they have had lots of experiences which they want to sort of talk about. Also, women have had for such a long time a thing of just not being believed when they talk about things, and stuff which might not seem a big deal to you, sometimes, you know, when you have this stuff happen to you all the time, it does kind of grind you down.
Well, I can see that, but to go back to the Spice Girls and that generation of the 90s, when you had this kind of defiant, you know, sense of anything was possible, I'm not going to be a victim, these young women wouldn't say, oh, I'm going to give up everything for my man, and oh, I'm worried about upsetting a man's feelings.
Cosmo, I was around
Jerry
the Spice...
Jerry Halliwell, are you kidding? She'd have done anything.
But do you think, honestly, so many women, like, for example, like me, I was probably, in my late teens, early 20s, one of the Spice Girls, they were taken with a massive pinch of salt. They were complete creation of a male music industry, and they were still great fun.
That's
and
not
people,
quite true, actually.
It is, actually, because I do actually work
true.
In the music industry and do some advising for them. But they were fun. They were really fun, and they definitely sort of shook things up. But the idea that they were sort of some kind of feminist nirvana. Actually, there were some other interesting bands at the time, like All Saints. Yeah. I don't really know Bikini Killer. Maybe you could lend me.
Well, they created French Girl Power.
You're kind of, but I think there were other bands as well. There was a lot of women on the kind of indie scene as well. I think you can't look at the entire feminist movement through what's happening with a manufactured pop band.
I wouldn't attempt to do that at all.
I think you just did.
Well, I was just a little nostalgic for a time when there was a definite sense of confidence and there was a kind of buoyancy that I'm kind of, maybe it was a bit of a fantasy.
But how can you say there isn't? Look at women like Beyoncé, look at Adele, look at Taylor Swift, look at Little Mix.
Taylor Swift's last single was called Look What You Made Me Do.
So what? She can write about what she wants. She's an incredibly powerful icon.
There she goes. That's a perfect victimhood title.
No, it's not.
Look What You Made Me Do. You know what that is?
She is brilliant and she's got a huge following. Look at Little Mix. Little Mix are an amazing band. Well, like,
the spirit carries on, yes.
So I think your argument doesn't quite work to say that, like, everybody, women are not empowered now and popular music is not female-led. Look at Beyoncé. Beyoncé is like this warrior woman for sort of, you know, empowerment and go-getting.
I don't say those things don't exist. We have an incredulous member of the audience here. I'm not saying those things don't exist. I'm just talking about a certain strand. I'm all for that. I'm all for the Beyoncés and all whatever. It's that other strand that I'm questioning.
And Cosmo just mentioned an incredulous member of the audience, and we're delighted to also be joined by our editor, Fraser Nelson. Fraser, what is it that you've clearly been wanting to say?
I mean, Cosmo, the Geisha generation music you speak of realistically died out in the 60s. We think of Dusty Springfield's Wishing and Hoping, right? The archetypal Geisha song, wear your hair just for him, do the things he likes to do. Then you get Nina and Frederick's song, When a Woman Says No, She Means Yes. You'd never get that released now. These things died out in the 60s. The 70s was warming up. By the 80s, you had the Eurythmics, Sisters are Doing Things for Themselves. And ever since, the tone of female music has been along the more empowerment line. Now, sure, you can't judge society by what people produce, but you can sort of see people's preferences reflected in what they bring. You know, Aisha, you mentioned All Saints, and that Never Ever, you know, this bit with the speak before, she's talking about contritely about how she broke up with her man, and if you tell me what I did wrong, I'll never ever do the same thing again.
You know,
right?
All the words, I love this, I love this.
But, no, but that stood out at the time because it was a very unusual bit where the woman was saying, it was my fault, I did it wrong, please tell me how to change. Now, not that much was read into that, but did stand out. Cosmo, the way that men and women react together may have changed over the decades, but musically, it stopped in the 60s, didn't it? I mean, can you...
Well, these things stop and then they start again. Not a clear linear development.
But what was the last Geisha-ish song, if you want to call it that? Well, what was the last
Wishing and Hoping? That's true. It hasn't caught up yet. This new generation, you're absolutely right, but the new generation, the Geisha people, haven't created pop because it's still unacceptable. It's not a form that you can do it, but you can do it in op-ed articles. You can do it in memoirs. The culture just hasn't caught up. Pop music hasn't caught up with this particular strand.
But I think Beyoncé is particularly significant because her music has called men to a certain higher standard of relationship. I mean, take Bills, that she did with Destiny's Child. That was complaining about a man who wasn't able to provide for his woman, a good-for-nothing type of brother. Take my card, use it all day, don't fill up the tank. She was complaining about the poor quality of behaviour of the man who doesn't respect it in a relationship. And now, then if you move on later on to Take Put a Ring on It, there we are, Beyoncé singing about the failure of men to propose to their ladies. She sits on the stage, she moves her wedding finger back and forth. She's saying these men are not stepping up now. But when you look at it then, you've got something which is unusual. Lots of women who would otherwise be as sort of feminist as Aisha here, they are singing along and dancing to a woman who's basically saying to them, you should be getting married, which is, I don't know if you call that female empowerment or not, but it's an interesting juncture. But the Geisha period, as far as I can work out,
Yeah, that's true. In popular culture, it has not given an expression there, but it has in terms of commentary post Me Too debates. It happened in the New Yorker story, is a classic example of a woman. If you read that story that went viral, there is the voice of Geisha. It's not in pop music, I grant you. There it is in Elio Ferrante's writings. You can see it emerging in different aspects of the country. It hasn't done in pop music yet.
Well,
that's true.
I read that piece and I love Elena Ferrante. I love her four books about My Brilliant Friend. And actually, I think those four novels were incredibly powerful from a feminist point of view, because actually they were about really strong women, that society is still very stacked up towards male needs.
I don't accept that.
I think hopefully that is starting to change and it will change. But going back to her novels that she wrote very brilliantly, I mean, they tell a very, very laboured, intensive story about the struggle of two women through growing up through children and then the pressures of their lives. And a lot of it is around the patriarchy and the pressures
but
on them.
You seem to be having it both ways. On the one hand, we've got the Fraser school of thought that says, look, it's all dead. Pop music's moved on. All these wonderfully empowered women. And you're saying, well, actually, nothing's really much changed. We're still suffering from patriarchy.
There's a difference between society and music. And the Beyoncé is the inversion of Dusty Springfield. And and that song is laying down standards that men have to meet rather than talking about male standards which women have
Fraser,
to meet.
Fraser, would you not agree that most of the songs you've mentioned have all been about men? So women are sort of singing about men. I mean, why do women feel they have to sing about men, do you think?
Men and women sing about each other. People sing about love. Probably about 4/5 of songs are about love in one way or another. It depends on the gender. And, you know, it's difficult to read too much sociological path into the lyrics of these pop songs. So I would say, look, Beyoncé aside, because she is an incredibly articulate voice of social change in Britain and America.
Thank you, Cosmo. Thank you, Aisha. And thank you, Fraser. That's it for this week. If you enjoyed it, please do subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store. It's called The Spectator Podcast. And please don't forget to also rate and review us if you like it. We'd love to hear back from you. As well as all the pieces discussed today, we've also got great articles in this week's issue from Matthew Paris, Prue Leith and our editor Fraser, who interviews Anthony Scaramucci on Trump, China and Russia. And if you're interested in Russia, do join us on the 18th of April when Andrew Neil will be discussing what does Russia want with a variety of different guests. You can subscribe to the magazine now and receive a free ticket to this event at spectator.co.uk/Moscow. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.